rocketed as a baby from the exploding planet Krypton. Kal-El grew to manhood on Earth, whose yellow sun and lighter gravity gave him fantastic superpowers. In the city of Metropolis, he poses as TV newsman Clark Kent, but battles evil all over Earth and beyond as Superman. Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 11 of Superman in the Bronze Age. I am your host, Charlie Niemeyer, and before we get to the reviews this week, I've got a couple of announcements I want to make. First of all, I would like to reiterate, if you would be interested in being a guest co-host on the show, please feel free to write in at umbc81@gmail.com, and we'll see if we can get you a spot on the show. So far, I have recorded with one super guest star, and we had a lot of fun, and hopefully he'll come back, but I would love to see if there's anyone else that would be interested, so please make sure you write in. Second, we have some big news. If you've been listening to From Crisis to Crisis, or if you remember from a couple episodes of my show, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor from Crisis to Crisis have kicked off a movement inspired by a recent Ask Matt posting, which involves one of their favorite Superman stories, Dark Knight Over Metropolis, which guest starred Batman from back in 89 right around the time the first Batman movie came out. It's a book that's never been collected in any way, and the only way to show DC Comics that we really would like to see it reprinted is by sending in a bunch of emails. Now, when I brought this up on the show, I want to say it was episode 9, I actually included a clip from their show, and they mentioned everything, but they did not know who was in charge of putting together the trades or hardback books at DC Comics. But they have found out. Ian Sattler is currently the man in charge. So the email address we need to send the emails to is ian.sattler@dccomics.com. Again, that's ian.sattler@dccomics.com. Now, here's the guidelines that we need to follow. First, in your own words, explain why you think that the story is important and should be published in a collected format. Second, remember that Ian is a busy man, and he might receive a lot of these emails, so we want to keep these emails brief, especially for his sake. Third, we don't want to be rude. We want to be really nice because we got to remember that we are representing Superman fans everywhere, and Superman, of course, would be nice about this. So don't say things like, why hasn't this been collected? It is really stupid that this has never been collected. We want to be nice about it and just point out why we think it should be collected and try to be really nice. And most important is we want to mention that we heard about it on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. It has nothing to do with ego for the guys. It just gives a focused voice for the movement. So remember, we have to mention that it's from Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, that we heard about this. Okay? The most important part is after we've sent the email, if DC agrees to print the book, we want to make sure we pre-order it. It's important to buy it, but it's even more important to pre-order when it's solicited so that DC knows to print enough of them. I and both Michael and Jeffrey and the Superman homepage, and I'm sure other sites, will make the order information available when and if it's solicited, so that you'll be able to either order it directly from the Superman homepage or the Diamond ordering number at your local you can use the Diamond ordering number at your local comic shop. So we want to make sure we do all of that. And what we're really asking is that for marketing purposes, that we want it collected as Superman Batman Volume 0. That way it's set before the actual Superman Batman book started up, but it's a very important Superman Batman book. Okay, so having said all that, I'm going to play a quick promo, and we will move on to the reviews.
December 7th,
Earth 2,
1941,
a world very much like our own, yet slightly different.
A date which will live in infamy.
A world at war.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Following the Japanese sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt brought together the largest group of mystery men ever assembled to battle the Axis powers. Tales of the Justice Society of America presents the All-Star Squadron. The Tales of the Justice Society of America, every Friday at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Presenting Superman.
Okay, and we've got Superman number 240, cover date July 1971, but was published May 13th, 1971. It's got a great Neil Adams cover. This time there's no disfigured people on it. It's just Superman. Looks like he's getting very frustrated while the public is, I guess, shouting at him and yelling at him, and he's holding a newspaper that has a headline, Superman Fails. And the title of this story is called To Save a Superman. The story is by Denny O'Neill. The art is by Kurt Swan and Dick Giordano. And the editor is Julie Schwartz. And we start off with a large apartment building on fire in Metropolis, and Superman shows up to see if there's anything he can do to help, and it turns out that they have someone stuck up on one of the higher floors, but the fire is on the lower floors, so they can't actually get past the fire to go help them. So Superman takes off, and as he does so, some of the people in the crowd figure that this is a foregone conclusion that Superman's going to save the day, so they just leave. Some of these are actually even tourists. And Superman, of course, can overhear them with his super hearing, wishing that he was as confident as they are, because as you will recall, over the past couple of issues, Superman is not at his peak performance level right now. But he crashes through the side of the building, finds the mother and her two children laying on the floor trying to stay under the smoke. So Superman picks them all up, crashes through the wall again, and lands them back down outside. However, as he's doing that and telling them, you know, trying to help the kids feel better, the owner of the building pretty much acts like a real douchebag to Superman and tells him, hey, save it. Come on, please. Well, actually, doesn't even say please. Basically, he says, that's my building there. Are you going to save it, or are you just going to rest on your laurels? Because they're not allowed to say but or something back in the 70s. So Superman attempts to do his best. Everything's already starting to buckle as he gets up there. He tries to hold back the side of the building, but both physics and the laws of physics are against him, and he can't stop the building from collapsing. And fortunately, he's not injured. He digs his way out of the rubble and walks off with his head hunched over. And the next morning, Daily Planet has a headline, Superman Fails. And we are in on a meeting of the anti-Superman gang. And they're trying to decide if they can really believe this headline or if this is just some kind of joke. But the head guy, who we don't actually get a name for, pretty much says that I think this is real, and it's worth a gamble to see if this is true. So the next day, or actually later that same, well actually it is later that the next day, the next day, we see Superman for some reason on a walking patrol, apparently, and of course we've got some construction workers and guys making jokes about how he's not really doing a good job anymore, buildings falling on him, asking him if he wants help crossing the street because he wouldn't want to stub his itty bitty toe. And of course Superman's frustrated by this because he's done all this good stuff for all these years, and they one mistake, and apparently they've forgotten all that. He continues his tour when he hears some cannon fire, and at first he says, you know what, it doesn't matter, they don't care about me anymore, I don't care about them. But then he comes to his senses and gets back into character and realizes, you know what, I've been fighting crime for as long as I can remember, and I just got to do what I be what I am. So he leaps off, and we see that the same Superman or anti-Superman gang from earlier is trying to rob the bank, and they've got a large cannon that they used, obviously. And they're taking their time emptying the vault because the real point of this whole exercise is to get Superman. He starts coming in. Of course, he's going slower because he's not at full power. And they start shooting at him. And since he is going so slow, they're able to actually get a bead on him. And basically, they just keep hitting him with the cannon fire. And after about four hits, he pretty much collapses. And that causes Superman to have a bit of a flashback, remembering the sand Superman creature. And Superman decides, you know what, he can still take these guys down. So he goes inside the bank vault, rips the vault door off, and throws it at their cannon, basically knocking all the men off the cannon. I guess off the cannon will work. And then, of course, by that time, the police have shown up and arrested the members of the anti-Superman gang. And back at the Galaxy Broadcasting, Superman switches back to Clark Kent, thinking to himself about how that door was a major effort to rip off, considering he used to be able to flip planets around like marbles. And he needs to figure something else. He's got to figure out something because right now he's a washout as a Superman. And Jimmy enters, Jimmy knows that Clark's in a file office, or in the file room, because of course that's where Clark changes, and tells Clark that there's someone in his office waiting for him, an old gentleman. And Clark goes to his office and sees that it's I Ching, and who has been a friend of Diana Prince, aka Wonder Woman, since she lost her powers around this time. And he starts talking about the fact that he does know that Clark Kent is Superman, even though he's blind, and he might be able to help him. So Clark says, well, why not? I've got nothing else to lose, so I'll see you tonight. And someone, it looks like a young kid, teenager, working at the Daily Planet or GBS, not sure what office this is supposed to be, because, you know, there's both, calls the anti-Superman gang and points and lets them know about this recent development, because he's been told to keep an eye on all of Superman's friends. So that night at I Ching's apartment, which looks like it's a basement apartment, they see Clark enter, and he quickly switches to Superman once he gets inside and lays down, and I Ching begins I don't know how to put this. It's kind of like, well, let's just say he starts the seance kind of thing, thrusting psychic fingers into where his spirit resides. And while he's doing that, the anti-Superman gang sneak into the apartment, and I Ching starts to be able to pull Superman's spirit out of his body, so that it may be examined and cured. But at that point, the anti-Superman gang make themselves known, and which upsets I Ching because he should have been able to sense them, but he was so busy and intent on his task that he didn't even notice them. He tries to stop them, but of course is quickly knocked out because he is blind. And one of them stands over Superman and decides he's going to try to see what happens when he hits him with the butt of a gun, and it hits Superman and he forms a bruise on his forehead. It does knock him out of the trance, though. As one of the members is about to shoot I Ching, Superman quickly gets up, punches one in the gut, goes after the one that's about to shoot I Ching. He shoots at Superman, and the only thing that prevents Superman from getting hurt is the indestructible costume he's wearing. And with one punch is able to knock out the shooter. And the other two guys are there and have pulled their pistols by this point, and Superman dives in and pulls a Batman and does a couple quick punches to them, and basically considers this to be his greatest victory because he did this without any of his superpowers. And at this point, he starts thinking that he doesn't know if he'll ever get his powers back, and right now he doesn't care. And that's the end of that story. Let's see. Notes on this one. First of all, I do want to point out this, of course, was reprinted in Kryptonite Nevermore hardcover from a couple years ago. It is the only time this issue has been reprinted. Page 3, the owner of the apartment building that's on fire is rather rude to Superman, basically taking him for granted. Like, okay, you saved them, now save my building. I mean, come on, he's not God. Although at this point, people were kind of used to him having the powers of a god, so I guess I could understand it, but it just doesn't seem nice. On page 5, I really don't think he would have been able to stop that building from falling if he had his full powers. Now, I'm thinking the current version of Superboy with his tactile telekinesis might have been able to hold it together, depending on how powerful that is. But Superman, basically he would have held up that wall while the rest of it tumbled. So basically he would have just held up one wall. So I really don't see how he could have done much. But what's funny, also on page 5, is this makes front page news about him failing. And granted, some of them were published after this story, but he's failed before. We've seen him fail in earlier issues of Superman, in action. I don't know why this. I mean, yes, I understand the building fell, but it should. I mean, the building falling should have been the headline. I don't know why I'm saying it's because Superman failed. And I know it's Daily Planet, and I know they're supposed to be objective. But I just don't see Perry White allowing that to be published. But then again, Morgan Edge is in charge of the Daily Planet, so he's over Perry's head, so he could have made them do it that way. I don't know, but it just doesn't make much sense to me. Page 6, like I said, Superman apparently is on a walking patrol. They don't actually mention this in the story, but I don't know why out of nowhere Superman's just walking around. He can still fly, or at least do some leaping, so he should be able to do his normal patrolling, but for some reason he's just walking so that he can get made fun of easier, I guess. I don't know. And, of course, like I said, he's calling them ungrateful people, and it just seems really out of character. But then again, the people are out of character. You can't make fun of the guy because he wasn't able to save one building, and then you're going to make fun of him. I mean, the guy can still stop bullets. He could still basically burn you with a glance. So it just doesn't seem right. I mean, I can understand people would do that, but still, it's Superman. I don't see that happening. I mean, I don't know about you, and I'm not trying to be political, but there have been presidents of the United States, of course, in the past or in the current or in the present, that I don't completely agree with and their policies. That's fine. Everyone is entitled to that. In fact, I've been on Facebook and I've heard people be that way. That's fine. But I'm gonna tell you this. If I actually had an opportunity to meet the president, it would probably be still really cool to shake his hand. I don't care what president it is, even if it was Nixon, probably. Hard to say. But, I mean, it's still the President of the United States, and just to see the guy, meet the guy in person, is going to be something really cool and something not a whole lot of people can say. These guys making fun of Superman as he's walking by, I could see that happening to any regular Joe Schmo, But basically, Superman's a celebrity. It doesn't matter. I mean, heck, Lindsay Lohan. If I got to meet Lindsay Lohan, I wouldn't be, like, making fun of her to her face. I do that on the internet. just kidding. But it would still be kind of cool to meet her. That's all I'm saying. Page 11, the dialogue on that one page is pretty bad. Last panel on page 11, the kid's talking like he's from, literally the 40s radio show. He's like, you said to report any funny stuff going on with Superman's pals. Well, this old Chinese just yacked with Kent. And then the guy calls him Charlie Chan. And give him a call when he'd light someplace. I know people have talked that way, but these guys are like mobsters, basically. And they're not going to say that kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, well, Superman, Clark just talked to some old Chinese guy. And then the other guy would have said, follow Charlie. I could see him calling him Charlie Chan. But give me a call when he, you know, gets someplace or something. It's like, light someplace. Page 15. Again, I think it's kind of out of character. I understand that he's just had this big victory, and so he's kind of pumped up on adrenaline and everything. Superman is just beating up these guys without any of his powers. But I would think that he would also be even more determined to get his powers back because of how difficult that was. And he should realize that he's going to have people coming after him that are expecting him to be at full power, and he won't stand a chance against them. Lex Luthor comes to mind. The more members of this anti-Superman gang, I don't know if this is everybody, but he barely took them out. They came at him earlier in the issue with a big cannon. Granted, he's got his indestructible costume, but if they had shot at him in this condition, he would have died. So, but anyway, and I say but anyway a lot. Probably gonna start drinking anyway. And overall, though, I do think overall the story isn't perfect, but it's still a pretty entertaining story. And I actually kind of like the change of pace on the inks a little bit. Giordano is a really good inker. He really allowed more of Swan's pencils to shine through than Anderson's been doing lately. It kind of gives it a harder edge, which I kind of liked, compared to kind of like the softer edge that Anderson gives. And the other thing I thought was interesting was, I don't know if maybe he helped ink the cover, or just because of how similar his style is to Neil Adams. But on page 9, when Superman's doing his flashback about the Sans Superman, the second image is basically, not exact, but it's very similar to the cover of 234, with the Sans Superman flying overhead and Superman falling at that weird, it's not a weird angle, it's a cool angle, but at an angle you don't normally see. And that just looks really cool. I mean, granted, it could be Swan just copying the cover, but whether it's Kurt Swan or not, the fact that Giordano's inking it kind of gives it more of a different feel. I guess is what I'm trying to say. I don't know. It almost doesn't even look like Swan on that image, but I mean, you can't tell it is. It's got the Swan Superman face and the S and stuff, but the rest of it just looks a little weird. Anyway, that's all I have on that story. We're getting close to the end. Of Kryptonite Nevermore. I think this is 240. We've only got about two more issues left, so it's really starting to gear up.
Boys and girls, your attention, please. Presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of an amazing and incredible personality.
Faster than a speeding bullet.
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman, a journey through the golden age of the Man of Steel in comics, radio, and film. Available at greatkrypton.com.
Everyone knows that baby Kal-El was sent from Krypton to Earth by his parents, Jor-El and Lara, shortly before the planet was torn apart by violent internal pressures. But what else do we really know about Krypton and its history? Journey with us now as we explore the fabulous world of Krypton. Okay, Fabulous World of Krypton. Title of the story is called The Man Who Cheated Time. It's written by Kerry Bates with art by M.W. Kaluta. We start off in the Scarlet Jungle, and we learn that underneath the Scarlet Jungle is a hidden security arsenal. And there's we follow a custodial engineer who's going through cleaning the place, and he finds that there's this newly installed chamber. And he's heard the rest of the personnel whispering about it, and he wants to see what it is. So using his laser key, he's able to open the door and sees that it's a machine called Tempor, and that it's been condemned by order of the Science Council. And to learn why it's been condemned, we go back a little while. I'm not sure. It doesn't actually say how far back, but we go back and to a story that begins with the malicious ambitions of Zolmar, a young apprentice scientist working with Malva. And Tempor is a device that he's created, and this is the day before the big demonstration of the Tempor device. And Zolmar says that nothing could keep him away, and that after tomorrow, Malva will be in disrepute, while Zolmar will gain fame and fortune. And we're left to wonder why a little bit. As he's walking, I guess, home, we see what appears to be a demonstration by some unruly students who are using basically lasers to destroy the statue of Darnex, Krypton's most famous military leader. He continues to ride. Looks like he's riding a lift, and points out that General Darnex ruled Krypton 1,000 years ago, and Zolmar believes that that was the real ideal society to live in, and that these demonstrators would have been executed if he was still in charge, because he knew how to maintain law and order. So we're kind of getting an idea of what kind of person Zolmar is. And he says that in just a few hours he'll actually be able to meet the great general and make him realize that he's got incalculable value in this military society. And you're still wondering, how's that going to happen if that was 1,000 years ago? Keep reading. So Zolmar gets in his vehicle. I don't know if you want to call it a car, but it's a vehicle. Actually looks kind of cool. And he says he's going to visit some of Malva's scientist friends. So first, he goes to his friend Thraxel, one of Krypton's most celebrated inventors. And they're talking about Tempor. And suddenly there's an implosion that goes off, and we learn that Zolmar had actually sent a remote control implosion device to go off while he was visiting. And basically he's gone in to steal an illusicon, which Thraxel has invented, which is supposed to make an illusion on everything and anything. So basically what he does is he grabs a piece of pottery, uses the illusicon on it to make it look like the illusicon, and puts it back, and then leaves. So then he goes to the laboratory of Krypton's most foremost meteorologist, and he's used the illusicon to make himself look like Malva, and asks to borrow the miniature weather regulator. And this is just continues to go on with his plan. Next, he goes to protobiologist Ron Rue. And as Ron Rue actually finishes talking to someone on his visiphone, which is basically a video call, which you can basically do with your iPhone now. And he answers the door to see it's Malva, and he comes in to ask to borrow his proto-synthesizer, because it has recently been perfected to create life forms. Suddenly, Ron Rue turns around with a blaster of some kind and says that you can't really be Malva, because I was just talking to him on the visiphone. So Zolmar, even though he looks like Malva, is a lot more capable than Malva is, and with a swift kick to the gut, knocks Ranru down, and then takes the gun and blasts him, basically disintegrating him. So he goes and grabs the protosynthesizer anyway, and we learn that these devices may be new now, but 1,000 years ago they were undreamed of, and back in Darnix's time, he will be acclaimed as a scientific wizard and be the general's right-hand man, or at least that's what he thinks. And so he goes home, I suppose, doesn't actually say it, but the next morning, under the austere scrutiny of the Science Council, at least that's what it says. We only see three members of the Science Council here. The plan is that the Tempor device will project his assistant into 1,000 years into Krypton's past, and then after about 10 minutes, the controls are programmed to return him to the present. However, we learn that Zolmar has sabotaged the time machine to short-circuit immediately after it lands, and so he will stay in the past permanently. And Malva activates the device, and basically we see his respiration, heartbeat, and metabolism rates. The instruments are actually able to keep track of him no matter where he is in time. At this point, he's 545 years into the past. And suddenly, Zolmar realizes that if he possibly materializes in the middle of Darnix's warriors, they might think he's a spy. So he's going to use the Illusicon to change him into a man no one would dare to harm, and turns himself into General Darnix himself. However, this energy pulse reverses the time directional impulses, and now thrusts him forward in time. So Malva decides he needs to bring him back. He throws the switch to pull him back, but it's already too late. Zolmar has gone 12 years past them into the future, and suddenly his life signs come to an end. And the council says that Zol is dead 50 years from now in Krypton's future. The invention is now condemned, and all time travel experimentation is now forbidden on Krypton. And we learned that the reason, and of course on the bottom we learned that the reason that Zolmar died 50 years in the future is that by 50 years in the future, Krypton had exploded just the day before Zolmar reintegrated or whatever. So basically, this story takes place 50 years before the explosion, 50 years and one day. I kind of like this story. It has you think that he's going to do something to sabotage the experiment to make Malva look bad, but that's actually an indirect, it's actually an inadvertent thing. He basically is still planning on going back to the past and letting that work. He just is going to stay there forever. Of course, he doesn't know that, like we do, that you can't mess with history, and he wouldn't actually, and of course Malva doesn't know this either, but by going back in the past, he could have been there, but he wouldn't have been able to change history anyway, so Zolmar, this whole story was for naught, but he didn't know that. Again, this story is reprinted in the Best of DC number 40 and in the Superman World of Krypton trade paperback. On page 2 is really my only note in the actual story, is we see that there's protesters on Krypton, which you don't really hear much about. Usually you hear about how it's a peaceful society, and basically the only person that you ever hear about having anything to say against Krypton is General Zod, who later gets arrested. Granted, there are criminals, but the only other one that seems to have any kind of dissent against the council or anybody seems to be Jor-El, when he's trying to tell everyone the Krypton's about to explode. So this was pretty interesting to learn. And that's another reason why I'm liking this fabulous world of Krypton. You're really learning a lot about the planet before it blew up. There's protesting. Basically, it's a lot like Earth, yet very different. It's really interesting. And like I said, this it's a good story. The art is really good. Not quite as good as what Gray Morrow, in my opinion, not quite as good as what Gray Morrow did last issue, but still really interesting, very detailed. In some instances, it kind of reminded me of Brian Boland art in a little bit. Some of it, not all of it. Kind of it, it it's very different from what you would see from Kurt Swan in the rest of the story. So that's, I thought that was pretty cool. And the only problem I had with it is why no one thought about the fact that why did he die 50 years in the future if he was going to land basically in the same place? Maybe they run to him. I mean, granted, that would change history, so I could see why they didn't. But think about how things would have changed if they actually investigated that. Also, as far as the art, the costumes actually kind of had that retro-futuristic look. A lot of the costumes reminded me of some of the pieces of art I've seen from, like, 30s and 40s era Buck Rogers stuff, where everyone's, or even, like, they're wearing futuristic-looking outfits, but they all have capes, and some of the guys are wearing shorts that look like skirts and stuff. It's a lot like that. It's pretty interesting how it looks. And that's it for that issue. There's no World's Finest this month, so I'm going to go ahead and play some promos for you and be right back.
Coming October 31st, 2010, Superman Forever Radio, a new weekly podcast which will focus on Superman and his family of comics, movies, television shows, cartoons, radio shows, and more. Featuring the latest news, reviews, and the latest and classic adventures of the Man of Steel, an in-depth look at a variety of topics throughout Superman's 70-plus years of history. Join host J. David Weider every Sunday for Superman Forever Radio, coming October 31st, 2010. For more information, go to supermanforever.com.
While attending a demonstration in radiology, student Peter Parker was bitten by a spider which had accidentally been exposed to radioactive rays. Through a miracle of science, Peter soon found that he had gained the arachnid's powers and had, in effect, become a human spider. Stan Lee presents...
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches seeds just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man.
Welcome to Amazing Spider-Man Classics, where every month I and some friends will be discussing every book, every guest appearance, and every cameo we can find of our favorite web-slinger, The Amazing Spider-Man. Are you tired of arguing over whether Ben Reilly should have taken over the webs? Do you grow weary of the brand new day with all of its controversy? Then return with us to the early days. Return with us to the classics. Amazing Spider-Man Classics at Amazing Spider-Man.
.libsyn.com. To him, life is a great big pain. Wherever there's a hang, you'll find the Spider-Man.
Look, up in the sky.
It's a bird.
It's a plane. No, it's SupermanHomepage.com, the number one Superman fan site in the world. SupermanHomepage.com, covering the world of Superman from the 1930s to today. News, reviews, rumors, and reports. SupermanHomepage.com for all your Superman comics, TV shows, movies, cartoons, radio shows, and more. Everything you ever wanted to know about the Man of Steel and more. SupermanHomepage.com.
Superman is a copyrighted feature appearing in Action Comics magazine.
All right, Action Comics number 402 has July 1971 cover date, published May 27th, 1971, with a cover by Neil Adams and Dick Giordano. And this time, if you recall, this is a continuation from last issue. We saw Superman being led away on a wooden pole being carried by some Native Americans. And this time, we see that they've got him tied up, I'm guessing, to the same pole. It's hard to tell with a different artist. And they basically got it in a fire pit. And as you know, Superman doesn't have any powers right now, so this could very much hurt him. Now, again, none of the stories in this issue of Action have ever been reprinted to this point. And this first story is This Hostage Must Die. The writer is Leo Dorfman. The art is by Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. The editor is Murray Boltonoff. And again, Superman is created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. We start off with basically a recap. The whole village is alerted to something big going on at the place of sacrifice, and they're gathering wood, and there's a small recap, takes literally 2 pages. And basically it takes away a lot of what we actually read last issue. Basically cuts out the whole part with Old Snake and his medicine man stuff, and basically just makes it sound like Superman asked Haldane not to build the rocket base there, and offering to build it somewhere else, and he says no, this is the perfect area for it, and the country's needs come first. And then it just skips right ahead to Red Hawk using the medicine science to take away Superman's powers and having him tied up. But as it ends, Red Hawk has his fellow guys use smoke signals to let everyone know exactly what's going on. And at the rocket base, they've just about got the rocket into a concrete silo to have it ready for launching for the launch test tomorrow. And one of his people sees the smoke signals and mentions that he learned how to read them when he was a kid in Boy Scouts, and that it says that the Navarros have captured Superman and they want to trade him for Montezuma's castle, which we know is the area where the rocket test site is. And a few moments later, another gentleman comes up saying that Superman's cape was left by a Native American at the gate as possible proof. And of course, Haldane says this can't be right. So everyone get back to work. And he takes it to his personal office, and using a blowtorch or acetylene torch, it can't burn the cape. So therefore, he thinks that this is real. So he turns on his emergency radio because he knows that Superman's always handling emergencies. And what we hear is we've got someone calling for Superman's help when a volcano was erupting. Another one calling a ship calling for Superman's help because it's been stranded on a reef since the day before. And then a news broadcast on TV, which usually we just see that this would be GBS, but it's not saying that in this instance. And that Superman has not been seen in 24 hours and that Supergirl is away on a mission in space. And once again, apparently, the Superman comics seem to have forgotten that there are other superheroes on Earth. And let's see. So quickly, Haldane changes to what they call a space uniform, but does not look like a space uniform at all. Basically looks like a jumpsuit with a weird-looking helmet and a handkerchief. Is that what I'm seeing? You don't see it anywhere else, but on this one image, it definitely looks like a scarf or something around his neck. And he moves fast, and he's got a piece of old parchment, and he says he's got to hurry because he's got the FBI and the CIA will be swarming around there soon, and if they do, his whole scheme could go up in smoke. So he gets into the rocket, and we learn that the rocket is not designed to go up, but is designed to go down into the earth and is actually a mechanical mole. And it's digging down into the bluff known as Montezuma's Castle. Meanwhile, above the Navarro ancient land of sacrifice where Superman is being held, we see police and other kind of armed force helicopters checking the area to see if they can find Superman, and all they see are forests of cacti. And meanwhile, down below, Superman's looking straight up at these same helicopters, wondering why they can't see him. And it turns out that Red Hawk explains that they can't see him because, it's like as was mentioned last issue, he's an astrophysicist. So he was. So he's smart enough to invent a mirage projector, which is keeping them all hidden so they can't help Superman. Now Superman at this point is using some X-ray vision he's got, his X-ray vision, to look inside one of the helicopters, and this confuses him because he's not supposed to have his superpowers. And then all of a sudden, Moonflower and a couple of guys come past with a small child, who it turns out has hurt himself and may have been broken, and they can't get him to a hospital because the authorities are hunting for the Navarros because of the fact that they've got Superman. Well, Superman's X-ray vision is still working somewhat. It's not at full strength, but it is working. And he's able to see that the lad's shoulder is only dislocated. So they're able to fix that up and take care of everything. So that helps. And then that can fix the shoulder temporarily until they can actually get to a hospital. And then for his assistance, Moonflower comes back with some water for Superman. And as she pours the water into a cup, some of the water spills onto the little, I'm not sure what to call it. Apparently it's the magic sand painting is what it is. And somehow Superman understands the magic behind the painting as he takes the water. And he asks Moonflower to pile some of the firewood around him. And she says, okay, but why? And he says, hold on a second, I'll tell you. So she piles it around him, and using what he still has of his heat vision, he sets the wood on fire, basically making it sound like he's going to kill himself. And Red Hawk runs off because, you know, he's kind of scared and can't believe that this is happening. They only wanted him as a hostage, so he tries to get someone to help him break up the fire. And when they finally get the fire out, they see that Superman is gone. And then Moonflower explains that at some point, somehow, some way that I don't understand, Superman explained to Moonflower that his X-ray vision had finally detected the source of the magic was the jewel, not the sand painting, and that apparently it has figured out that as an astrophysicist, Red Hawk was able to invent a jeweled lens which siphoned the rays of a distant red sun, and then was able to direct those rays at Superman, which is what knocked out his powers. So he created the fire, which created enough smoke to block those red rays and allowed him to get enough power to escape. And so now Red Hawk thinks that this is bad, and Superman will probably try to seek revenge. But Superman is actually still feeling sorry for the Novaros and says that they must be desperate if they're going to such extremes to get Montezuma's castle back. So he goes back to the rocket base at super speed to try to make one final appeal, but he uses his X-ray vision to locate Haldane on the base, but can't find him anywhere. But he is able to spot the mechanical mole as it's drilling down into what we don't know yet. And Superman flies in and burrows through using his superpowers, and it brings him out into the tunnel that was dug by the drill, and follows it down and sees Haldane in a large cavern with treasure of the ancient Aztecs. And when I say treasure, I'm talking about there's piles of gold and statues and jewels and everything. And the drill has actually got some light on it so Haldane can see. And Haldane tells him that the story was all figures that the story was all a trick just to capture him and smoke him out. But Superman points out that crooks like you always trap yourselves. Superman rips off the skin of the rocket, and we see that the ship is already almost practically full of gold and jewels. And Haldane offers to share it with him, but of course Superman says no, he has the wealth of the worlds at his command, and Haldane will have no need for money in the pen, which is where he's headed. And the next day, Superman shows it all off to Red Hawk and says that the government has returned the land to him and that the treasure rightfully belongs to the Novaros. And a few months later, we learn that the Novaros have used the treasure and the money to build schools and hospitals and farms, and that Superman's going to make his own contribution to the new community. So he's created a door and carved a cavern out of the Montezuma's Castle Bluff, calling it the Montezuma's Castle Museum. And it's basically is like an Indian, almost looks like a Native American version of basically Superman's door to his fortress. And it's a vast museum that Superman has now created so that the Navajos can also share the Aztec treasures with their fellow Americans. And already we've got lines of people flocking to the grand opening of it. And Red Hawk thanks him, and Moonflower gives him a kiss on the cheek, and says that he is their superhero now. And Superman flies off. And that's the end of that story. And that's actually, again, we have another, it's a pretty good ending to the story that was started last month. And I hope that Leo is able to continue on this pace, because this is pretty good. It means not the best I've ever read, but this is pretty good Superman storytelling for this time period. And I actually got kind of excited seeing Superman with his powers again, so I got sucked right into it. In this story, though, on page 3 and 4, now you got to remember that this story, Leo Dorfman only has 14 pages to tell this story. This is an era where everything was compact. Instead of having 7-part stories at a time, or 6-part stories where you basically only tell 2 stories in a year and then having them go right into a trade paperback to be sold at Barnes & Noble or Borders, was basically trying to get it almost one and done, maybe 2 at a time, maybe a 2-part story. Because this is like the 3rd or 4th one he's done that's a 2-part story. But again, this is that era where everyone was trying to keep it kind of condensed. And he actually uses 2 whole pages of a 14-page story to do the flashback to last issue. And it doesn't even include everything. Doesn't seem to be real judicial use of the storytelling pages. Granted, that might have been Kurt Swan, but I don't know. Page 6. Once again, when we're seeing everyone calling for Superman's help, I get the feeling that they're taking Superman for granted. Literally, it's like, Superman, why aren't you answering? Why won't you help us? I mean, come on, people. Now, granted, I don't live in a world where Superman's real, so I don't know how I would feel, but I would think that with him only being one man, maybe they wouldn't be like that, but apparently they are, and that is one of the few things that actually seems to be somewhat consistent between Superman and action in this era, is that everyone's taking him for granted, so I kind of really feel for the guy. Page 8, I thought it was kind of convenient. Every time Dorfman has had Superman lose his powers, which has been, 2 or 3 times now, it hasn't actually been all his powers like we were originally led to believe. If you remember that imaginary story, he still had his vision powers. And again, this time, he still has his vision powers. It takes a little extra effort, and it's not full power, but he still has his vision powers, which he's able to use to escape. So it's like, it's almost like maybe Dorfman wrote himself into a corner and then was like, oh, you know what, maybe if he still has these powers, he can still do it, because those red solar radiations should have knocked out everything. That's all I'm going to say. Page 12, I thought it was really funny when Superman sees the treasure, but without telling us what he's seeing, his first reaction is great galloping galaxies. I'm used to hearing him say, or hearing, but I'm used to reading him in this era say, like, Great Krypton or Great Rao or something like that, but Great Galloping Galaxies is a new one on me, so that's interesting. And I know all the heroes at this time had special sayings to go with them, like Wonder Woman's was Great Hera, Green Lantern was Great Guardians, Aquaman was Great Neptune. I know Batman liked to say Great Scott a lot, so that's all I could say about that, really. Page 14, I thought it was kind of funny. It's just kind of the way they did storytelling back in those days, but I thought it was pretty fitting. It's a good thing they had Red Hawk and Moonflower explain exactly what was happening so that they didn't have to waste a caption box. Basically, what we're looking at is Superman's putting the door in, and we've got Red Hulk saying, Superman, carve that cavern into a vast museum so we could share the finest Aztec treasures with our fellow Americans. And then Moonflower says the tourists are flocking to the grand opening, which, of course, they wouldn't normally say. And if this was real, one, there'd probably be a little more to do. Second, there'd be some more guards, I would imagine. And I hope that there's some kind of protection so that all these people aren't going to steal the treasures. So, but anyway, so I thought this was pretty cool. And I don't know why, but I, again, the art, the Kurt Swan Murphy Anderson art, is better here than it has been in Superman, and I don't know why. It's a little bit different in this month because of the fact that Murphy Anderson didn't ink Superman, so it's hard to compare them. But again, this issue was on par with last issue, which I thought was well ahead of the Superman issue, and it just kind of is confusing to me because they're, now, granted, I don't know how it was at the time, but reading it 40 years later, it seems to me like everyone goes on and on about how important and how awesome and how classic the Kryptonite Nevermore story is, while no one mentions anything about these. And granted, some of these haven't been the best, but for, and maybe it's because of the longevity of Action Comics, and maybe it just seemed more important. But for some reason, it's just Swan and Anderson, it just seem to have a better rapport on their art stylings and stuff in Action than they have in Superman. It just, it seems like they would want to make sure they brought their A game to the other stores, since it was supposed to be having a significant change on Superman than this one. Granted, you would think they'd have their A game both times, but you know what I'm saying. So it's just kind of weird. Like I said, part one was a little more entertaining to me, but this was still had a pretty good conclusion. Of course, with the using two pages for the recap, they kind of had to cram the ending into like two pages also, which kind of crammed it in, but it still worked. The backup story in this issue is another Tales of the Fortress backup called Superman vs. Supergirl, The Feud of the Titans. This one is written by Jeff Brown, aka Leo Dorfman, with art by Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. And we start off seeing that Superman and Supergirl have returned to the fortress. And for some reason, they despise each other. And while Superman's entering the fortress using the normal door he's created, Supergirl has actually created her own entrance so that she doesn't have to be near him. And as Superman enters the place, we see that the fortress is filled with some kind of noxious fumes, some kind of green gas, and quickly mentions that luckily Kandor isn't harmed because it gets its oxygen from a special tank. So Superman uses his super vacuum, his super breath in reverse, and sucks up all the, I guess you would call it super suction breath, to suck up all the gas. However, it doesn't seem to work, and the next panel we see there's still plenty of gas floating around in the place. So Superman tears off at what appears to be full super speed, heading towards the Supergirl wing of the fortress to have it out with her. However, he crashes into an invisible wall, and on a nearby monitor screen, she explains, rather nastily, that she has created a barrier of super force, which even he can't penetrate. And for some reason, Superman doesn't believe her again, and he tries again and again, and it's still not working. And so, unfortunately, she did not take into account the Hall of Trophies in the fortress. So Superman goes over and destroys a sword that she was given for saving the gem planet of Tresor from space pirates, melts down a gold statue from the Amazon world of Feminol. And I don't know how old this statue is, but it's got her current costume. And then Superman holds up and sees that there's a twin-headed bird from the planet Duplor, where life forms have mutated and evolved like Siamese twins. And he realizes he can't destroy that because that would mean he would have to break his code against killing, which kind of brings him to his senses. And makes them wonder how it all started. And we learn that it started, one day. So I don't know how long ago this was. They're both on a vital mission, Superman and Supergirl are, from the UN Disarmament Commission to destroy a whole bunch of outlawed weapons at the fortress. And if there's one slip, the whole world could be polluted or even destroyed. So they go into the rocky depths of the fortress to this disintegration pit that Superman has created using radioactive Kryptonian elements from Kandor, which will dissolve them into their molecular components instantly before they can cause any damage. So they start throwing in objects. So they throw in a jigsaw ray, a seismotron, which creates earthquakes, and a vapor bomb. And suddenly, as they're going up in smoke, apparently they're just about finished, but Superman spots that Supergirl has hidden a weapon called a laser, which is a souped-up laser gun, which should be able to even hurt him. But Supergirl gets back at him, saying that it looks like Superman has saved a cryogen freeze wave projector, basically like Mr. Freeze's cold gun or Captain Cold's cold gun. So they quickly get their weapons and fire them at each other. Of course, they counteract each other because one's heat, one's cold. So that doesn't do anything. And we start seeing that the whole room is filling up with a green gas. And now all of a sudden they really hate each other and are fly off towards, and Supergirl basically declares war. And Superman, just thinking about it, it gets worse and starts getting mad at her again. And decides he's going to take all of her super, instead of wasting time and his powers on her trophies, he's just going to take them down to the disintegration pit. And Supergirl spots this and goes through the wall and dives down through the rock, drilling to where the where the disintegration pit is. And it actually says, as the sound effect, pow, pow, power. Which reminds me of the Power Wheels commercials from when I was a kid. Pow, pow, Power Wheels. Anyway. Supergirl shows up and tries to stop Superman. She flies over the disintegration pit, but because it's Kryptonian, it affects her differently, or actually almost the way ordinary radiation would affect a human, a normal human being, because they're abnormal, I guess. And she's in the pit, and she's in pain. Superman comes out of whatever he's under, hating her, and says that he's gonna tries to help her, offers his hand for her to grab it. She says no, she'd rather die. But Superman says that you're gonna die. The only thing saving you is your costume. You better take my hand if you don't want to die. So she eventually grabs his, or either she grabs his hand or he just goes ahead and grabs it, and flies her out. And he seems to have come to his senses, and he realizes that something made him want to save her. So he takes Supergirl and those birds, and they go outside of the fortress. And all of a sudden, we see that the bird heads, are billing and cooing. So Superman comes to realize exactly what's going on, and he uses his X-ray vision and has Supergirl do the same, looking in the fortress, and sees the green fumes still throughout the fortress. And it turns out that those fumes were from that vapor, that brainwash vapor bomb. And basically what it was supposed to do, it contained a hate gas that were used by a dictator to make his troops loathe his enemies. And basically, when that gas combined with the radioactive Kryptonian elements of the disintegration furnace, it also affected them, causing them to hate each other. And of course, out in the fresh air, they don't hate each other anymore, and they feel a lot better. And they're going to work together as a team, and they clear out all the fumes from the fortress. And Supergirl removes her fortress, her extra door, because they're a super team once more, and they can share the main entrance. And that's the end. And this one I have a lot more problems with. I don't know if it's because it's shorter page size, but I have more problems with this story than the other one. First of all, like I said, Superman's supposed to be clearing out the gas on page 2 using his super suction breath, on page 1, but on page 2 it's still there, so he didn't really do a good job of it. Second of all, did he swallow it, or did he have some place to blow it away? Otherwise, it's just going to affect him worse. Just thought I'd point that out. Page 4. This disintegration pit is rather huge, and I'm wondering how he was able to get enough radioactive elements from a bottle city to fill up this giant disintegration pit, and if he was able to get a small amount and then somehow enlarge it to normal size, why couldn't he use whatever device he used to do that to enlarge, you know, Kandor? I'm just saying. Page 7. Superman mentions that the only thing protecting her from the disintegration pit is her costume. How does that work? It's as Kryptonian as they are. Basically, in that situation, it's Kryptonian. So basically, what we've got is basically what would the exact same thing that would happen if a human, a regularly clothed human, got into a regular disintegration pit, which, of course, is common all over the world. And so if you say you fell into it, no matter how much clothing you're wearing, you're going to disintegrate. And this is Kryptonian, so it affects them and their clothing the same way it would affect us and our clothing. So therefore, her and her costume should have dissolved and been gone, and I should say good riddance because I don't like this costume anyway, although she would have been kind of naked, which wouldn't have been right for a 1970s comic. But also, when the bird is starting to feel better outside, it's not only cooing, but it's like hugging itself and looks like it's making googly eyes, like it's going to make out with the other head. Kind of hard to explain, but definitely looks like it's going to try to put the moves on itself. So, I don't know how that works when you've got two heads. Anyway, page 8. They mentioned that the fumes were taken away, but they don't say how. I think that would have been a cool story. It's almost like I kind of wish that they had used this story as a main story to try to flesh out, maybe fix some of the problems, and show how they took out the flame of the fumes. And also, they don't explain the fact that removing the giant door, Supergirl door, would have left a big hole in the side of the fortress. So I would think they'd have to fix that, but they don't mention that at all. Unfortunately, if you read this story, not just because of the way I'm pointing it out, this was the first time I read this, I had this figured out, and I'm not usually this smart. This gas is pretty big deal. The fact that Superman tries to get rid of it, but it's still there afterwards. And as you go back from it, you can see his changes in his mind. But you see him in the gas as he's having all these problems with Supergirl. He starts taking apart her trophies, but suddenly the gas isn't around him anymore when he's like, how did this happen? How did it get this way? As he does his recap. But it's like as soon as they're throwing in the first objects, you see the green, a little bit of that green gas coming out of the disintegration pit, and basically right there, and that's on page 4, it kind of blows the whole thing. It's like, I wonder if that gas has something to do with it. And also, it's kind of weird that they mention it comes from the vapor bomb, but Supergirl hadn't actually thrown the bomb into the pit when we see the gas coming out. So maybe it was just supposed to be smoke that was colored wrong, but yeah, that kind of messed up the whole thing, kind of gave it all away. Also, they mentioned that outside they're feeling a lot better, but the story begins with them outside heading into the fortress, and they're hating each other. And basically they shouldn't be if they're outside. It shouldn't be until they actually get inside, so that kind of screws that all up. But, yeah, not a fan. Too much of this story. I liked the first one, but he kind of went downhill on this story. Hopefully that's better next issue. But that's it for the Superman books from this month. Real quick, I'll go over the elsewhere in the DC multiverse. We have DC Special number 13, which is The Strangest Sports Stories Ever Told, which doesn't look like it has any superheroes in it, but it's still pretty cool. Oh, and before I keep going, this is from DCIndexes.com, Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics. Just wanted to mention that. So thanks, Mike, for this, because I know just about all the podcasts are using you now. So thank you for having this cool site. We have Falling in Love, number 124, asking the question, is he only fooling you? We have Our Army at War, featuring Sergeant Rock, number 234. We have Super DC Giant, S25, which features 64 pages of colossal Kirby classics from the Challengers of the Unknown. And basically, it's three stories. Wow, so those must be pretty big stories, but if you only get three in 64 pages, or there's a lot of ads, I'm not sure. We have Wonder Woman, 195. She's still in her white outfit. We have Son of Tomahawk, number 135. We have Batman 233, which, like Superman 239 from last month, appears to be all reprints. And I can tell that because the editor is E. Nelson Bridwell, and he appears to be the main editor whenever they do these 64-page reprint issues. Still has a pretty cool cover, though. We have Girls in Love, number 160, which has a special story of My First Kiss. And also, Barbara Miles presents Your Love Problems. We have Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane, number 111, which actually has the story of Lois Lane trapped by the Justice League. And it totally looks like Gulliver's Travels. Lois is in a bikini, which is not something you normally see Lois wearing, but she's in a bikini, and the Justice League are all little, like the Lilliputians, and she's laying on the ground, and they're using bat rope and they're all using their powers to tie her down to the ground. She seems to be unconscious, but we see Green Arrow shooting the rope across. We've got Black Canary. We've got Batman, Green Lantern, Hawkman, Aquaman, Flash, and Superman all trying to tie her down. Plus, there's a promise of a Rose and Thorn story. So, that looks weird, but interesting. We have Do You Dare Enter the House of Mystery, number 193, which has a really cool-looking cover. We have Our Fighting Forces, featuring The Losers, number 132, and based after the last couple of issues, I'm guessing they're still, they're still the losers. We have a really cool Neil Adams cover on Phantom Stranger, number 14. And it looks really cool. It's called The Spectre of the Stalking Swamp, which does not feature the Spectre, but has a creature that looks like it could be Swamp Thing's cousin. It looks really cool. I just really like Neil Adams' arts. Mike says art. We have Young Love, number 87, featuring Follow Your Stars to the More Beautiful You. That's pretty nifty. We've got Mr. Miracle, number 3, which looks pretty interesting because Mr. Miracle is in a costume that is all white and features something about the paranoid pill. But it's got a really cool Jack Kirby cover. We have Secret Hearts, number 153. And this one has the stars telling you when you'll find your man. And I don't know if that means like the up in the sky stars or like movie stars. We have Super DC Giant, number S26, which features Aquaman in six of his most spectacular adventures. And like I said before, basically by this point, Aquaman had been canceled. So it's pretty interesting that they'd even do that. We have Superboy 176 with the secret of Superboy's sister, which I don't understand. But, yeah, we have Teen Titans number 34, the Demon of Dog Island, which has a cool Nick Carty cover. We have Date with Debbie, number 16. Again, that's 16 or 64 pages for 25 cents, and it still looks like an Archie book. And this allows you to meet America's typical teenager, Maureen McCormick. And that would be Marsha Brady, for those of you keeping track. And we have Girls' Romances, number 158, which offers the to let you know how to develop sex appeal, because kids reading comics are looking for that. We have Jimmy Olsen, number 139, which actually features Superman meeting Don Rickles and Goody Rickles. Yes, that's right. You can read more of that, of course, at the Superman homepage in their classic pre-crisis reviews. But that was an interesting story. We have Adventure Comics 408 featuring Supergirl. And her costume looks different here. When Kurt Swan draws it, I don't know, it looks like it's miscolored on this cover. It looks like she has these little red booties, like Robin's booties. And then for some reason they color her legs red, but it looks like they shouldn't be. And then her belt's bigger and stuff, but I don't know. It looks different than what we just saw in Action Comics, so maybe she changes it for that issue, I don't know. We have Detective Comics number 413, featuring the Freakout at Phantom Hollow, which has another really cool-looking Neil Adams Batman cover. And then, last but not least, we have Strange Adventures 231, which does feature an Adam Strange story and the Attack of the Flying Gorillas, which actually looks like a pretty cool cover with a giant gorilla with wings attacking a couple of planes. So that's really cool. Anyway, basically that's it for this month. I want to thank everybody for listening and for downloading this episode of the podcast. Please make sure you check out the other really cool Superman podcasts at the Superman Podcast Network at www.fortressofbaileytooth.com/Superman Podcast Network. And thank you again for listening, and you all have a good day.
Thank you for listening to Superman in the Bronze Age, hosted by Charlie Niemeyer. You can write to the show at umbc81@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show two ways, via the RSS feed at supermaninthebronzeage.blogspot.com or via iTunes. Also, if you like this show, make sure you check out the blogs and podcasts listed in the recommended sites section, and be sure to check out my reviews of other classic Superman comics at www.supermanhomepage.com. Superman and all related characters are copyright DC Comics. Also, any images or music used for this blog or podcast is purely for entertainment only. I do not make any money from this show. Thank you again for listening, and God bless.
Superman is also a copyrighted feature appearing in Superman DC Publications.